Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And yes, we even got on about a minute early or so. That's very nice. I just found out that sometimes they like me being on this radio station, actually all the time, I think, and that's good news. So, hello, everybody out there. Tonight we're going to have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality and science and you name it, it's going to be probably thrown in. I thought we'd talk about spirit, invention, and its mother. Now, you don't think that's a play on words, do you? At any rate, one of the key elements of tonight's show has to do with the idea of invention, because many people have a misunderstanding of what it means to invent, of what it means to create something that has a connection to both usually things, sometimes technologies, but more often we'll say a means of being expressive of a new part of life. And after all, this is why life is, so after all, we should be talking about anything that is new parts in it. Invention definitely is part of that. The reason spirit, let's talk about spirit. Spirit is really the thought of God. The best way to describe it is it's the two parts of that make up thought, which is the two parts of the mind of our Creator or God. And it's present because the three parts of God's mind were separated by God itself. God said, hey, you know what? I'm not going to keep everything I am together. I'm going to stay together myself, but for the rest of the universe, I thought that I'd give it a chance to be creative itself, to have its own invention, and its own mother of its invention. And all that being said, it made a lot of sense to God to allow its own creation, which is life, to be free to create itself, both more of itself and more of anything else that it's going to be involved with or be a procreator of or be a creator of. So this is the interesting part about how our universe functions. It's kind of a neat thing, if you ask me. I like that about ageless wisdom, is that it describes the universe with an openness and the ability to be growing rather than the same and predictive, and some people would even say determined. So the universe is none of those things if you follow ageless wisdom. And if you're into some aspects of science, especially in physics, the quantum physics parts of physics, different than classical, follow that same tenet, that basically there is no predetermined nature to even subatomic particles, which make up the particles that make up us. So when you get to even the very smallest of the small things that are around us, they are not predetermined in how they function. Now, in a more classical approach to physics, everything was like a clock, and it was predetermined. So if you knew that the time and the space and direction, et cetera, of something, you could determine exactly where and what it was going to be doing whenever. In quantum physics, that's not true. And quantum physics is really the basis, the proven basis of physics, whereas classical physics is the observed basis for those in the macro world, us, you know, big people. But it doesn't apply, and it isn't the truth about what's underlying and what's really happening. It's just our illusion that things seem to be predetermined, when in actuality, there is no predetermining, even for the most basic of laws and the most smallest of things. This means, using that just that single premise that I just told you about, that the proof, we'll call it, of our universe being created by a being who is seeking to allow its its creation, which is us, life, to express itself instead of express only that thought that is predetermined by its creator, is the single most prominent element to the thought of God itself or spirit. I think this has a lot of ramifications, and especially myself, I consider myself an inventor. Maybe not. I may not be Edison. May not be. But, you know, we all have our means and ways of inventing. And some people that are considered not inventors, such as an example, authors and writers, which I include myself humbly among, there's a lot of invention done in that, whether you're writing things that are nonfiction, which I do quite a bit of, or fiction, which I've done some of. The point is that invention is really a means of allowing ourselves to enter into the part of spirit that is predominantly, we'll call it, the male aspect of God's mind. It's the first part of God's mind, which is considered a male kind of aspect. Why is it male? Well, it's what we identify as male in our vernacular. I don't think God has, in its beingness, male, female as separate issues. But nonetheless, if you separate its mind, the first part of God's mind appears to be male, based upon our perceptions. And the second part appears to be female. Okay? And this corresponds to a lot of other parts of how the physics of the universe add up. Without going into them tonight, I'm just using this as an expression of tonight's named show and where invention really leads. Invention tends to follow the purpose and creation principles of God's thought, which is the first part of its mind, sometimes referred to as first ray types of energy that follow this thinking. And then the second part has to do with taking the invention itself and directing it so that it has some concrete results, some actual definable qualities that remain and affect a lot of other things. Some people will call that affecting the field that the original creation of thought existed in. So it has to have an effect on the overall field, and that's the mother of it. Now, some people say, well, I thought the mother of invention is, you know, 95% perspiration, you know, 5% inspiration. Well, that's one person's statement. I think that was Edison that said that. But it is also true that the necessity of actually creating something that goes on and has a life of its own is included in the concept of invention. If you invent something in a closet and it never gets out of your closet, and you go and peek at it once in a while, but it doesn't do anything for anyone else, or even possibly for you, then I would not call that invention. I would call that a pre-invention or maybe pre-creation or something of that nature. But it doesn't follow that it's affecting the rest of things in the field that are similar to it, and therefore it is isolated. And the isolation of invention is the reduction and the diminution of invention. So if you invent things and then you don't do something with them, even if it's write about them or talk about them or something, then they become, in their idleness and in their complete, we'll say, isolation, a virtually meaningless expression of both purpose and creation. So that's the idea here, that you have to go further after you create something for it to be a true invention. It needs to be expressed in ways that affect other inventions, other people, other life, and it has to express your own, it has to even affect your own life. Some people tell me they're inventors, and I say, what have you invented? They say, well, I got this idea in my head. Well, I say, well, it's a great idea, but an idea is not an invention. Because ideas alone, if isolated from the field that they can go on to affect, because no action is taken, no interaction is held to be effective, those things become, again, by their own isolation, reduced to a part of a thought and not even a complete thought. Interesting ideas. So spirit, invention, and its mother really is putting together these parts of our Creator's mind in a way it has some viability, some life of its own within our universe. It has some effect on others, including other inventions and other inventors. Interesting. I think that most ways that we gauge invention in terms of their importance is by how much they spur on others to invent more, sometimes to reinvent the very first invention in new and better ways, and sometimes to go on inventing totally new things that in some way connect, or sometimes that offer alternatives to or reversals of the original invention. But regardless, we gauge the importance of an invention by all of those things, don't we? So even on our scale of, we'll say, somewhat emotional reaction, also thought, but somewhat emotional reaction to people's inventions or inventions in general, we look at these ways that the invention have effects on the world around us as how important an invention actually is. Very interesting in itself, because that means that when we define invention, we are also defining all of the connections that invention has on all other people, including ourselves, though, in its wake. And this is really a way of seeing that there is no such thing, in my opinion, as a true isolated invention. Or it's not an invention, it's a negation of invention. Something that is part of and becomes a part of the world around us in various ways, that's true invention. All right, so someone who is just sitting around, quote-unquote, inventing in their mind but never expressing anything with this mind is not a true inventor. And those of us who are inventors are connecting so many different dots based upon our own consciousness. Consciousness allows us to increase the level of invention because it allows us to connect what has already been created with new things that are out there and what was there prior. That's what consciousness does. It allows us to connect. And consciousness is actually the mother of invention. Consciousness allows invention to become truly what it is supposed to be. Now, you could claim an invention is something that is consciousness-less and has no connection to anything. And I would say that that's part of an idea, but it hasn't become an invention yet. But others could define it differently. I'm just giving you my opinion and how I would go about doing so. So what's so important about us inventing? Let's get to that part of the equation. Humans, when they invent, they do two things at the same time. They are affecting the field of life around them, making that field in them more closely aligned, and bringing all other things in the field that the invention has some interaction with closer together. That's a good thing. So invention in itself eventually leads to inclusiveness, which is part of consciousness. Wow. Not a bad thing at all. The other thing it does, and this is probably what a lot of people in tonight's show will be listening for and interested in, is that invention allows the inventor to raise their consciousness by the mere fact that they have invented something in my definition of invention, using my definition, which includes affecting the field and being inclusive. So each act of invention is an act of consciousness raising. And now let's see if the reverse is true, the converse. And because converse thought is not always true, but let's see if it is. So I'm suggesting, possibly, that when someone is being inclusive, they, at least at times, are inventing, but not always. Now I'll explain the difference. And this is why converse logic isn't always true. Let's say that we were to examine someone who is being highly inclusive by looking around themselves and trying to connect all of the those that are around them into a definable and understandable oneness. They could do this through historical accounts, through the work of many others who have invented before, and through numerous different means, including systematic tables and a kind of library almost system of cataloging all of the ways that people are connected. That's not invention. And yet it is a more inclusive thought process than to not do it in the first place. So the converse does not always turn out to be true, and here's an example of it. However, taking it a step further, someone who is inventing, and I mean inventing from the standpoint that they create a new way of thinking, a new way of interacting, and then they apply it to very many more people. In most cases, those situations turn out to be much more inclusive. But not all. What are the exceptions? Well, rarely, but it happens, evil invents. It actually creates something. When evil is doing this, and I'll give you some examples of this in a minute, it's lying outside of God's thought, and it's inventing from anti-God's thought. It's inventing against God. Let's say it's coming up with new ways to torture and destroy people. And maybe anything else alive. Okay, it's coming up with these new ways. Therefore, it's connecting more ways together, right? And we wouldn't say that it's being inclusive. It's being exclusive because it's exterminating parts of life and trying to get rid of God and all this other stuff. Yet, it is being inventive, and it is affecting the field that its invention is within, and it is using this in a very negative way. It's quite difficult for evil to do this, by the way, because it produces a lot of forces against it. And it has to be able to push all that energy onto other kinds of life so that it doesn't suffer the effects of the forces than the other life does. It doesn't mind when the other life does. It rejoices when it does. It just doesn't want the forces on itself. Okay, so that's the exception, and it's a pretty big exception because there's evil in the world, and sometimes evil events, and it does come up with it. Most of the time, that isn't the way it works. So most of the time, when people are creating more enlightening things that create more of God and help create more virtue in the world, the results are an inclusiveness is brought into the field that produces more consciousness. Evil doesn't necessarily lose a lot of consciousness because it forces the loss of consciousness on its victims and tries to maintain its own consciousness at a status quo. In reality, there's a very slight loss in consciousness no matter what it does, but it doesn't realize this until maybe thousands of years later. So, as far as it's concerned, it's not losing consciousness, although it really is at a very, very slow rate. And most of the consciousness is suffered and lost by those that are its victims. Sometimes its victims are just other evil people who happen to be at a lower rank of evil, and so they happen to get the brunt of it, and then they have to try to pass it off to even less evil people, etc. That's how it's sort of like handing off the evilness, the destruction, so that it's passed on to larger and larger numbers of people who will tolerate the level of pain and suffering at the relatively smaller levels, and they don't understand how to get rid of it anyway. So this is how it works. So invention does have some, we'll say, negative connotations, negative realities to it, and it can be destructive. But for the most part, it isn't. And I would hope for all of you listening tonight, after tonight's show is we've done it, you'll have a much better understanding of how to invent in ways that are positive and creative, that have inclusiveness to them, and that affect the field that they are connecting together in ways that are very loving and very conscious, and have with it a sense of virtue in virtually every part of form that the invention interacts into. That will be the goal. Hopefully tonight's show will reveal ways we can get to that goal. And I'll even talk about some things in my own life. I'll talk about some other things. So this is a kind of, by the end of the show, we'll have some more practical sides. As you know, the first 40 minutes or so of this show, I talk about the more abstract stuff. That's to scare everybody away. And then I get to the practical stuff, which is a lot easier usually, and not so scary. All right. So this is a fascinating subject to me because the very concept of invention I'm using as I talk about invention. Yeah. I have never read anything that describes what invention actually is, how it tends to interact in the universe, and how it has these different ways of expressing both good and evil, and what this means in the long run for all of us, which, again, will be covered later in the show. So this I haven't seen before, and that's the reason I chose this subject for tonight's show. It's one of those kind of blank areas that in anything I've read, it hasn't covered enough of this. Now, there are some books, one of them is White Magic by Alice Bailey, that talks about how creation takes place from the mind into the astral nature of us and emotions, as some people would call it, and then eventually into interaction and form in the physical world. But it's very esoteric, and it really doesn't practically explain what invention is. It just says, well, invention is made through this thing called white magic, which really is the ability to put together three parts of humans' lives into a cohesive structure of both thought, feeling, and action, so that the end result is the creation or invention, would be another word, of a virtuous outcome is likely. It's recommended reading, but still very difficult, and probably not nearly as practical as tonight's show is going to be. But still, I don't want to discourage anybody from trying it, and also from just having enough contact with it to at least understand its contents, even if you don't want to try to actually use some of the value in the book in your life. I think there are easier ways for most people, unless you're very disciplined spiritually. Then white magic actually makes more sense to those folks. Why is that? Because the concept of spiritual discipline in itself is reinvention. Not so much unique new invention, but reinvention of the nature of the human into or back to the soul. That's the concept. So as we invent ways of rejoining with our soul, we become much more virtuous, of course, and at the same time, we're changing the field around us that we exist and interact with to do the same. And spiritual discipline is the foundation of that methodology. It's a good thing, but it's limited by the number of people who are capable of achieving spiritual discipline at this time in their life. Pretty small number of people. And relative to the huge number of people alive. So it doesn't have universal appeal. It isn't widely useful for most people. And that's why I'm going to a much different model, one that would allow a far larger range of people to enter into the spectrum of being creative of light in the world and helpful towards all others in truly inventing areas of both thought and interactions that leads most others to become more inclusive, as well as raises the consciousness of the inventor. So let's talk about the inventor. Well, what do I mean when I say the inventor? The inventor is a being who is creating more of themselves, just the way God intended, by being self-actualized, by recognizing that it is the self part of them and not the personality, the subconscious, but the self part of them, the conscious part of us, that allows us to become free to invent. So what I'm explaining here is that the basic foundation of invention comes mostly from the fact that individual selves are incorporated in human beings and not so much in animals. Yes, there's a few animals, very advanced, that may have a little bit of self. I'll go along with that. And certainly the ones that are in constant contact with humans, the pets, certainly do. Small, but they have it. But the vast majority of animals and plants and minerals are not inventive at all and do not have any self-structure. They're not aware of themselves. They just don't have that key element. And they certainly are not aware of God, not on a conscious level. And so this gets into what I'm trying to reach right now. The key to invention in a way which is not evil, a way that is inclusive, always includes elements of seeing some other aspect of God, our Creator. I don't care what you're inventing. It doesn't matter to me. What matters is that if you are actually inventing and you're following its mother, which is to affect the field that your invention is going to be in by making sure it more inclusively brings the field together and allows others to, through the inventiveness of what you create, to be closer together, If you're doing that, and closer means both awareness and the ability to understand each other, okay? What did I mean by that? Closer. Then, at that point, God becomes more visible. God becomes more revealed to the inventor in those situations. So when someone asks me, and I've had this asked to me many, many times, why are you inventing so much? You're such an, you know, almost compulsive inventor. Nobody can keep up with you. You're inventing so many things all the time. What I'm really doing is I'm revealing more and more of God to me through my invention, as I believe all inventors who are not evil are doing. Now, I may have gone a little too fast with that. That's a big one, I know. You go, whoa, that's a big concept. Yeah. Okay, so let's try to, I'll go back over it a little bit. That's one of those ahas when you get it, but until you get it, it's a, instead of an aha, because it's hard to get. Okay, let's look at it from this standpoint. Invention is our creation. Not God's creation. God's creation is that there be life. Okay, we're here. We're done. We're God. But to understand God in a fuller way than just to read about it, study about it, interact in some prayer or some meditation, practice love, practice givingness, those are all good things. None of these are terrible. They're good things. All those things involve the heart chakra, and they give us a greater understanding of God. However, if you truly want to be fully aware of God, fully aware, not just have some greater understanding, but not fully aware of God, you have to be a co-creator with God, using the head or crown chakra as your basis of the energy that you're using, which is called first ray energy, and on the basis that you are truly using the highest level of thought you can muster to think about whatever it is you're thinking about, regardless of whether it has to do with God or not. So when you get to that kind of level, you start becoming aware much more of God by co-creating. This is the thing that animals, specifically, have a great deal of trouble doing, almost cannot do. So animals are not great inventors. They're not. They do a little tiny bit, depending upon their overall level of consciousness. But mostly they're not great inventors. Humans are tremendous inventors because we've got this conscious area of these two senses or chakras, the heart and the crown, that are spiritual in nature and allow us to understand and eventually become fully aware of God through eventually co-creation, of which another name for co-creation is invention. Invention can be the replacement for the word co-creation. So you can call it co-invention then if you want. Now, why is that true? Why is invention a synonym for co-creation? Co-creation means that you experience or are more aware of God as you create using some of God's thought or spirit. Remember, spirit is God's thought. In what you create. And that's what the definition of invention is. At least invention that is godly. I'm not talking about the evil side. We covered that already. So I always am recognizing that the evil has a right to invent on its own, away from its creator, and to reverse everything I'm saying. But that's a different thing. Wow. So inventors that are real inventors are those who are co-creating with their creator and becoming more and more aware of God in everything around them. And this gets back to the beginning of the show. As you start co-creating with God, as an inventor, you become more aware of all those others who are doing the same, and therefore your invention becomes connected to all others' inventions because you're all co-creating together with and for God. And that's why that happens. That's why inventions connect. And the better, the bigger, the better, the more enlightened the invention, the more it connects with all other inventions. And that's how we subconsciously usually gauge the value of an invention. Isn't that fascinating? That we have like a built-in mechanism that without even realizing everything I've explained thus far in this show, we do it. We do it without even having to think about it. It's becoming second nature, maybe first nature, to human beings to carry out this complicated and difficult to understand concept, this huge concept of invention and what it means to become more aware of God. Wow. So, as a teacher, which I think of myself, some people do as well, the thing that I try to promote most in those that are receptive to what I teach is to get them to participate in inventing. I have to tell you that as a teacher and those that I have been involved in teaching, the area that I found the most difficulty is getting others to invent, even to get others to co-invent with me or someone else. Very difficult. Why is that? Because co-invention requires huge amounts of humility. It means the acceptance of other people's thoughts and interactions and creations as being equal to and sometimes better than our own. And only humility permits us to do that. So only the humble become inventors. Isn't that fascinating? There's parts of the Bhagavad Gita that refer to this very concept. The Bhagavad Gita concludes in Krishna's explanation to Arjuna that you know a soul by its humility. But in other passages of the same book, it's mentioned that the understanding and awareness of the Creator is connected through elements of purpose and creation that is joined with others, which is just another word for invention. Invention in a virtuous way. It's fascinating that even in books from literally 5,000-6,000 years ago, the same ideas were known about. Fascinating stuff. All right, so I have a great deal of trouble getting people to invent on their own. That's the really hard thing. Or co-invent with me or with others. And it is it's an epidemic problem. It's like it's everywhere, and it's not some kind of small problem because it's really required in order to gain this special kind of awareness, which I'm going to talk about in the next segment of the soul of the show. And so it's very difficult. Because there are so many people that are so resistant to becoming inventors of even the small things, much less the larger. Well, I want you to think about all that. Boy, have I given you a lot to think about, right? In about 39 or 40 minutes here. So we're going to go to break, and then when we come back in 2.5 minutes, I'll talk about some of the other elements that makes us inventors and why it's important to get to these places. And then some practical issues in our lives of how we can really work on these things. And some of the things that I have as a teacher that are real problems and then ideas I have of trying to overcome them. Okay, we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Welcome. We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. I hope you got a little breather there from that intense first part of the show. And, I'm going to keep it a little bit intense, but, I always do that the first 40 minutes there while I got your minds fresh, because I figured that if I waited much longer to go into those things, most people would not have the bandwidth to keep going with me. So I get you why you at the beginning and not worn out yet. Okay, so coming back to this idea, all right. There are points in each person's life when invention is both more important and sometimes easier to do. And this is recorded statistically if you look at the amount of inventiveness of people and their overall age. And you might say, well, what does that got to do with it? And I'll explain. But let's just talk about what has been statistically correlated. And that is that the age that most people are most inventive in generally is between the ages of 28 and 35. That's the way the maximum level, peak levels of inventiveness take place, with 21 to 28 and 35 to 42 being the other sides of a bell-shaped curve. So the peak is somewhere around 35. Now, you might say, why is it so young? Why aren't people becoming more and more creative as they grow older? Some people are. Some people actually do keep growing. But it appears, if you take the average of humanity, that does not bear out to be true in a statistical sense. And why do some young people have so many creative ideas, younger adults at least, have so many creative ideas and are able to make themselves into inventiveness or invention ideas by age 35 and then kind of peter out? Well, remember, first of all, if you have an idea, but you haven't brought it to any kind of fruition, that's not an invention by my definition. That usually happens between the 21 to 28 time, when more mental development may be blooming, but the ability to become more aware of God is not yet realized. Because in esoteric terms, it's about age 28 or so that most people start developing this heightened awareness of God that is required to make great ideas into great inventions. Before that, the person may have had the idea for years, even, but not have brought it to the fruition of being a true invention. Then what you say, well, why can't you just keep going? You know, what's so bad? You get 7 years in, and then suddenly, poof, it's start declining again, at least until 42, and then you really fall off the cliff. Well, yes and no. Depends on whether or not you're spiritually disciplining yourself or not. As it turns out, and this is going to be a little bit hard to understand for people who don't understand spiritual discipline, and I can't go too deep into it tonight because I've covered it in other shows. You might want to listen to those. But here's the point. Once you reach these middle adult years, the problem is that you can have mundane discipline, which is the ability to develop your lower self, and you can create your lower self into more of a functional person in our world. That's fine. But to become part of God requires the development of the heart and crown chakras on a conscious level, and that requires spiritual discipline, which means trying to create your lower self into a higher self, into a soul, where most of what you're doing in creation is for others and not for yourself. You can be selfish pretty much up to about 35 and be somewhat successful at creating somewhat more mundane but less spiritual invention, which will not lead to as great an awareness of God. And we gain a little bit, don't get me wrong. But it won't be enough to awaken you to the main reason, the main motive in the invention is to become more aware of God, which is what you need to become spiritually disciplined. Spiritual discipline comes from the literal, we'll call it spiritual desire, which isn't really a desire, it's a love of God, to emulate and become part of God by this increased awareness of God. And without that, people fall off the spiritual disciplines, we'll say, train. They can't keep going on that track because they don't have the guidance of their higher self and beyond their higher self, a thing called their monad. What's a monad? Monad is the most creative and inventive part of our soul. It's actually much higher than our soul, and it's what our soul came from. And the monad is what creates spirit and form. So it's like the granddaddy of everything. It's a huge being. And every human being has both a soul and a monad. And it has an oversoul, or some people call it an alter ego soul, or some people refer to it as a guiding inner guide or a solar angel. It has a being that's an energy type being that is even more advanced than its own soul and that helps its own soul out in its own thinking. and helps us too. So we have a tremendous amount of things going for us. But this monad is really important. The monad only will, on its own, choose to connect with us and make us a great inventor by giving us gifts of inspirational thinking that are intuitive rather than mental and come from higher spheres of thought, mostly Atmic and Buddhic, for those of you who understand those words. And this thought is so pronounced, it's so vastly superior to mental thinking. It's like the giant ahas that some inventors get, some people get. And this comes from monadically infused thought. And the monad will only do so, will only connect with us, when we have reached the level of invention by strictly spiritual discipline and thinking. Strictly. So you can't have this monadically infused thought given to you until the way you arrive at the door of the monad is by only through spiritual discipline in thinking, spiritual motive. If the motive is clear, if the thought is well together, put together, and balanced between the first and second parts of God's mind, balanced between purpose and creation along with direction and inclusiveness, those are all put together in a nice balanced package, then you open the floodgates of thought coming from the monad. That's the criteria. And the monad has four different levels that it will communicate with the human being on at certain periods of spiritual discipline that allows four different kinds of inventiveness on the part of the human being. And you say, boy, I never heard of that before. Well, if you read Life's Hidden Meaning, you know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, it's in some other books in esoteric form. It's just not clear. But now it will be once you listen to what I'm saying. All right, I hope. I'll keep my fingers crossed. Okay, here we go. The first has to do with the first level of initiation. And when we discipline ourselves so that our thought about the physical and etheric or electromagnetic parts of the physical world are extremely spiritual. Is spiritual as our awareness of God is at that moment. And that awareness will be about 25% of our total awareness and 10% of our interaction with the universe around us. When we reach that level, we have become accepted for contact with this great being, our monad. And it's literally like a beam of monadic thought, light, that will enter into our minds and hearts, opening us to a new awareness of God for the physical world and how to create inventions that lead to improvements in people's awareness about God through physical means, physical inventions. Now, what's a physical invention? It'll become more clear when I define what isn't, but for right now, I'll call a physical invention anything that deals with dense matter or electromagnetic energies, exclusively, without including any other sense from a human being other than the senses of those things I just described. Okay. That's what it allows us to do. So a person becomes an inventor of new things, and those things are physical or electromagnetic in nature, and they lead to an awareness of God through just that part of existence. Wow. Okay. That's the first. The second comes, and it's during the part of that initiation that I just mentioned, the first initiation, that this monad connects, is when a person reaches the accepted stage of the initiation, meaning that it needs more help from some other sources to complete the initiation. And the first help it gets is through the solar angel, then the second help it gets is through the monad, and the third part of the triangle of help comes from the spiritual hierarchy, which then completes the initiation for us. But that's how it works. Now, that may have sounded very far out there for people who haven't listened much but to the show, but that's how it works. Okay, then we get to the second initiation. And during the second initiation, it's the same thing. During the accepted stage is when we can have contact with the monad. And the contact with the monad here is no longer just about physical things. The physical things are there. But now we have to reach an awareness of up to 50% with about 25% of actually creation in the invention. And the inventiveness now doesn't just affect people and animals and everything around us on a physical and etheric level, but it also affects them astrally or emotionally, how they feel. It changes how people feel besides just how they physically interact and how they electromagnetically interact with each other. Wow. So that's what's going on then. And that's added on top of. It's not like you switch gears and you're not going to do the physical. The physical now has to be raised to a higher level of inventiveness while you're affecting the way people feel in general more towards love. So you're helping people to become more loving and more inclusive directly while you're helping them to become more aware of the nature of God through physical and electromagnetic invention together. It's all coming together through those two things. Wow, pretty interesting, huh? Okay, so then the next thing is during the third initiation, considered an advanced initiate, reaches the accepted stage, and now creates, using monadically infused thought, thought that it makes people more aware of God. Wow. Aware of God. In an intellectual, mental way. A monastic way. And once you're doing that, you're also adding that to the feeling structure, the love structure of a person or people, and to the interaction of form or physical matter and electromagnetic energies at the same time, all together. And the monad is infusing, while the solar angel is, during the end of this initiation, again, the accepted stage of the third level of initiation. You're getting this light, which is really God's thought, being infused into you to achieve these results. Other things are happening, too. I'll cover some of them in a minute. But this is the important part about invention. Now you've become a new kind of inventor, an inventor of new thought. Excellent idea. Good idea. All right? Then finally, you move into the fourth initiation. Now, the fourth initiation is different than the other three. Unlike the other three, which comes at the end of the initiation, the fourth level initiate has to start doing this from the very beginning. At the probationary stage, they have to be infused with monadic thought. And they have to be an inventor right from the get-go of their life. They're inventors, like they come out of the womb inventing, okay? And so this is one of the hallmarks of these kinds of beings, these kind of people. They don't just invent mentally. They don't just invent mentally at 28 to 35. They're inventing all the time. And now they're inventing, including a fourth part. And that fourth part is intuitive thought. They're using something called Buddhic thought, which is omniscient thought. They get inventions that seem to come from absolutely nowhere. They don't use any prior knowledge because there's never been any knowledge about it before. They discover absolutely new things, starting from the probationary stage on, the very beginning of the initiation. And it builds and it builds and it builds. And they start bringing together more and more ways that people can become aware of God, not through just how they interact in a physical and electromagnetic sense, or how they feel in terms of how loving they are, or how that mentally they understand things and they have a complete wise understanding of things. But now it's through life itself. They do it by the full experience of life, by living that life themselves, and also by helping others to do the same, first by saving their lives so that they can live their life, because oftentimes these people are saviors. So it's an amazing thing, and this being is now infused with monadic thought from birth on. Wow. And they usually have two or three lifetimes like this. They're born with monadic thought infused. Wow. And the awareness that they're deriving and helping others to derive is of a kind of inventiveness that qualitatively is even different from what I have described so far, because one of the qualities that now changes, since it's for their whole lifetime rather than at a certain point in their life when they start becoming this certain kind of spiritually disciplined person, it is an awareness that there is no such thing as themselves and others. There's only all of life, which is all a part of God, needing their stewardship and their help and service to grow and become more aware of their Creator. So the focus of this level of monadic infusion is of the monad itself directing from the beginning of the life the person, rather than coming in the middle and end of the life of the person to give that person a boost. This isn't about the person anymore. This is about a life of true service for all others. A sacrificial life, a life given up, if you might want to say, for others to become part of God. Now, the inventiveness is the issue here, because most of the time, those in the probationary and accepting stage of the fourth initiation are just vast inventors and do so, again, in a more selfless way than could ever be imagined. They don't invent usually for the benefit of themselves. They do it for the benefit of all others as a sacrifice, sometimes even to the destruction of themselves, so that others can move ahead. So the inventiveness is about salvaging others. It's about helping others to become better inventors themselves rather than they themselves remaining the best inventor. They will even give up their own inventiveness if they can help others to become more inventive. It's a pretty unusual position, if you think about it. And that's the difference. Eventually, that can lead, then, to becoming a member of the next kingdom, a kingdom of souls, where the human being is no longer human anymore, and it's become just its soul, and we call that, like, superhuman. And that being lives its life for the life of all. It doesn't see a separation between its life and all life. It sees all life as part of God, and it sees it in God as co-serving in virtually all things that it does. Pretty cool stuff. So that's the power behind invention in a spiritual sense. And that spiritual sense comes from and is fostered by higher beings, the highest being, the monad. It's really an amazing story of how invention is spurred on in a spiritual sense by this connection. Let me give you a little rest now. Pretty interesting stuff, huh? Well, today was an interesting day for me. I went and opened a bank account. I needed to do that. And a couple of them, I think, checking, savings, whatever. Went over to Wells Fargo Bank, and a young fellow who, his name is Eric, might be listening right now. Hi, Eric, how are you doing? He helped out. I always love it when people are trying to help other people to get whatever their needs are met, provided those needs are good needs, and Eric seemed like a good fellow. I'll say this for this particular bank, because I know some people that are working for it. It is a bank, apparently, that pays more attention to the human side of things and is concerned about the well-being of the people it serves and the people that are serving in place of it and for it. And it comes across in some of their employees, Eric being one of them. So if you haven't had a chance, you might check them out as a bank. I'm not recommending that they, in all of their institutional issues, are the best bank for someone. That's something each person is going to need to find for themselves. But nonetheless, if you're concerned about banks that are concerned about people, I think Wells Fargo fits into that category. Interestingly, I have a loan on a house, and they, via a bunch of other changes in the structure of buying out banks and changes, have become the lender de facto on my house. And so now they're my bank in that respect. They hadn't been before, and actually I haven't been banking with them on a regular basis. But now I think I will be, and we'll see how it goes. Check it out. Wells Fargo Bank, been around for a long time. They have a long history of trying to be of service to people more so than some other banks. And they've been, because of their length of time, I think they have a sense within themselves that they have a commitment to trying to do good besides just making a profit and becoming a bigger bank. Okay, so let's get back to invention and talk about the part of it that is so almost, I'll call it seductive, because I can speak again for myself here. When I'm trying to invent, it's not in any way, to me, an effort. It is almost a compulsion. As a matter of fact, one of the problems I have is that there are so many things that I am working on in an inventive sense that it can get in the way of the more mundane elements of daily living. And also in carrying out and executing prior inventions and having the time and space created that I create for myself to make sure those things take place. Why is that true? Because invention involves a eventual state of joy. It produces this state because the person that is inventing, if they're inventing virtuously, is again becoming more aware of God in themselves and around themselves. And that sense comes from their invention touching other people, or the prior inventions touching other people, that leads to this overall sense of God in those other people and in ourselves as well. That's where the sense of joy comes from. And so, because we all would like to sense more joy, right? It can be an intoxicating element. Now, one of the things I mentioned about the arhat, or fourth-level initiate, they sacrifice a great deal of that at times. Why do they do that? Because they could invent all the time, but then they wouldn't be helping others to become as inventive. And this is not what they're here for. They're here to do the opposite, to save others so they can become inventors, but in doing so, they lose their own inventiveness because they can't do both sometimes at the same time. So there's a great deal of sacrifice in that. And they sacrifice some of their awareness of their creator, and even some of their own senses that lead to that are diminished by those around them as they help them to become inventors, and they get resistance to that. Believe it or not, they do get a lot of resistance from it. This cuts down their own senses, reduces their ability to be aware of God, cuts down by a considerable margin the amount of joy that they have, and will increase significantly their amount of suffering because they lose consciousness. Remember, invention, when carried through, includes inclusiveness. But when others are refusing to be inclusive, that you're helping them to become more inventive themselves and then refuse, the results are suffering first on the part of the person who's trying to help the others do that. And our hearts are continually, almost continually, in that position. So they have a lot of suffering as a result of this whole issue. Now, they don't want that. I don't want you to think, well, oh, gee, I think I'll become a suffering person. No, it's not. They want to help others to become more aware of and a part of God, which means to co-create with God or become a real inventor, spiritual inventor, I should say. And they want to increase the spiritual invention in others, but at great cost to themselves on an individual level, they're willing to do. And that's what makes them so unique. Because other humans are willing to give, and they're willing to invent, and they're willing to do a lot of stuff. And especially in all the other initiations, they love being infused by the monad. But they have a lot of trouble trying to do so at their own sacrifice of themselves for the benefit of others who may have absolutely no appreciation for it and no willingness to even do more invention in the long run. Wow. And yet they still may try. Now, they don't do it endlessly to the fault of themselves and destruction of themselves, because that would be ridiculous. But they do it to a significant level of suffering. Suffering is different than complete annihilation. That's something to concern ourselves with, isn't it? And the reason that these folks can get away with that is because they have enough wisdom to know when enough is enough and they stop, so that they don't completely destroy themselves through the terrible selfishness of a few. But they will suffer immensely, willingly, to help save even one. All right, so then what are some of the other ways to look at increasing our spiritual contact with God through invention? Well, if you want to try to improve your own life in this respect, and I know that some people really have a hankering for this, others find it to be almost impossible, or have found it to be almost impossible at this point, This show may help you, may change that viewpoint. The way to become more inventive once you've reached this age and time in your life when it becomes almost impossible to do beyond the mundane level is through spiritual focus, spiritual life, interaction with spiritual people, maybe in a spiritual group, and certainly some level of spiritual discipline. Now, what do I mean by that, spiritual discipline? Like, you're supposed to have somebody telling you every 5 minutes you better be doing this or you're not a good spiritual person. No. Spiritual discipline comes from inside and not outside. Nobody can spiritually discipline you. Only you can do it for yourself. Remember that. It means that you limit your senses. You limit them so that they only are aware of godly ways of sensing and then godly ways of understanding what the senses are giving you in information. If it isn't godly, you ignore it until you find a godly way of sensing something. The ignoring of a sense is very difficult to do for human beings because the personality finds that challenging and a threat to its own existence. It wants to get all the information, and it doesn't care whether it's virtuous or not because it's there to control things and keep us alive. Thank you very much. But, you see, it has such a one-sided nature that it fails to recognize that awareness of garbage just produces more garbage. Awareness of converting garbage into light can produce a lot more light. In the interim, there's sacrifice and a lot of suffering. All right, so when we talk about spiritual discipline, we're talking about limiting our senses to the level at which we can respond in ways which are virtuous. When we can no longer respond virtuously, we must limit our senses even further to the level that we can. And for a lot of people, their personalities rebel against this. They don't want to be controlled. They want to be the controller. They don't want to have limitation on what they're sensing. They want everything. And if it isn't any good, well, it's too bad anyway. They got it. Let me give you an example of this so that it makes some sense to you. Let's say that you're going to go learn about animal husbandry, and you're going to learn about how to take care of and to help animals to live longer, better lives, etc. You pick certain types of animals to study and to interact with. Not a bad thing, nothing wrong with that. And in doing so, you're doing mundane discipline. What's mundane discipline? Well, you're applying some limitation to your senses so that you can become more aware of the animal, more aware of what it is that the animal or animals need to live better and longer, healthier lives, and that has more meaning to human beings that have interaction with them, and that is more meaningful to the animals, having interaction with themselves, other animals, and human beings. So you're all concerned about that, and it's terrific. It's all parts of what is called mundane discipline, but it's unspiritual. Now, let's say that you now want to get into spiritual discipline. Spiritual discipline means that you're going to help others to understand how to take care of animals because it leads to a more inclusive world, a more spiritual world, a world in which you can see God through the animals themselves, their interactions, and how they fit in to human civilization and human life in an ideal sense, not as they may be at the present time. Presently, we may be eating them, when the better thing is to not raise them for food, but bring them to a higher level of existence in their own form, to maybe to redevelop themselves into a new form of existence at a higher level. Wow. If all of that were true, you would start disciplining yourself spiritually. It wouldn't matter to you that you're just trying to help the animals. You want to help people understand animals so they understand God, and the animals get the effect of people loving them more because they see them more as life, so they develop themselves into higher and higher levels of animals themselves instead of being eaten or some other terrible outcome for them. So this is an interesting point now that I'm bringing up because in a practical sense, spiritual discipline doesn't really involve an awareness of a thing. It involves the awareness of God in that thing and how it interconnects with all other things to lead to more awareness of God in others. Yes, simultaneously may happen in yourself as well. So we are all learning and becoming more aware when we help others to become aware. There's nothing wrong with that. But our motive isn't to increase our own level of knowledge or even consciousness, which means understanding of the knowledge. We do it because we want God to be a greater part of all of life, the animals, the plants, and especially of the human beings, which we see as souls rather than as just selfish, personal people. We ourselves are then functioning more as a soul and not as a person when that spiritual discipline matches our ability to respond. It needs to balance with our ability to respond, or we're not being sincere. We're doing a half-hearted attempt. We're not focused on the maximum level that we can invent, as an example. Instead, we go for some mediocre level and say, well, that's good enough. So among spiritual disciplines that leads to spiritual invention, there are levels, and the level needs to reach the level where we can respond maximally, and then we are doing the noble or best we can do in a physical, human sense, to create light. This is the true, the real inventor. The real inventor is at that level of functioning. And if you're not an inventor or not much of an inventor in your life right now, start with the more mundane things, that's okay, with always the eye and the attempt to get to the higher, more spiritual foundations of invention, looking for purposes to help others to become more aware of, as well as more understanding of God, and helping them then paying it forward, doing it for some others. So everyone is starting to function as a soul. This is the soul's level of function. Souls are grand inventors. They spend almost all of their time in the higher mental world inventing scenarios together, hundreds of them or more, for future lives, and how they can create various examples of human beings using different parts of past karma to allow for the maximum level of growth of all, not for any one of the humans that they will create, because each one creates their own one single human being, but collectively they become a unit to each other, and they look for what is going to best increase in a truly inventive sense all of humanity for that period of time that their incarnated person is going to be around. And they work with thousands sometimes of others who are going to have interconnection with that person throughout their life. Fascinating stuff. Lots of times people think souls just sort of sit around doing nothing, and yet they are the most inventive of the beings below that of the solar angel. Incredible beings of great inventiveness, and from which we come and return to. So you can see why if we can invent here and now in the physical world, we are functioning most as a soul, provided that those inventions are spiritual in nature, representing God's thought, not some dark mess that's destructive to life and therefore God. Fascinating stuff in my mind, because the end of this process is we are not only going back to our souls, but because at various points in the journey we're infused by our monad, we're going back to being a monad. That's right. Our soul is eventually going to rejoin with its monad, but only after it has joined with its solar angel or energy being and become a great, great being, greater than the monad was originally. So the monad it's going to become is called an ascended monad, just in another even higher dimension from where monads go. Monads come from the monadic plane. But these beings ascend to the highest plane, the logoic plane, the plane highest in our universe, the plane closest to God, the plane where God actually is, the plane where we can directly sense God in everything and anything we do, and is really the main part of our life, is living in one with our Creator, but contributing to that Creator's creations on an endless, ongoing, amazing level. And yet co-participating with others who are doing the same all the time, not isolated. An amazing future. That's where we're headed. All because we are inventors. And the first of life to become consistent spiritual inventors. The first of life to be able to increase our awareness of God through everything that we invent. And the first to experience joy on any kind of consistent basis through our own chosen methods of invention and co-creation with our Creator, and giving that to other beings. What an amazing story. So where does this leave us at the present time if we're having troubles with invention? Well, the first thing to consider is fear. Most people are held back in their life from inventing because they are afraid to create almost anything because they're afraid of failure, they're afraid of consequences of failure, and they believe that anything that leads them astray from the norm, that is the average of so many people around themselves, will leave them lonely and isolated and without human friends and interactions. A lot of this is illusion, but this is some of the stuff, the nonsense, that the personality tries to convince us of so it can stay in control. Because remember, the more inventive we are on a spiritual level, the less control the personality has over who we are. And the more we are in control through our higher self and our soul of being something totally greater, more fantastic than any normal human would be. How important is this? Well, getting over the fear is a tough one, because most people had it infused usually through unfriendly parents. Our first experience of God is oftentimes through the projection of God into our parents. If our parents are overly cautious, overly critical, prevent us from experimenting and from being inventive, trying to limit that part of our existence, and to get their, we'll say, conditional love, we're willing to maybe compromise much of our invention when we're young, and then that leads into this kind of fear-prone and driven lifetime, which can be disastrous. To get over the fear, we need to see beyond the horizon. We need to see not just the physical world consequences of failure, but we need to see the success of being spiritual, whether or not in activity and material wealth and material terms we succeed. If we base our success on joy and on being our soul, there is nothing to hold us back, and there's no reason to be afraid. When we interject the mundane aspects and we become concerned about how much money we're going to have, what kind of friends we're going to have, what kind of reputation we're going to have, where we're going to live, and how much of this or that we might have to give up or keep, then our life is really held hostage by all of those elements becoming partial fears of failure and loss. If you're going to try and truly reach a point where all of the joy and all of the greatness of invention are part of who you are, you have to let go of those things that have these fears connected to them. The fear is the single probably most hostile and preventative issue in most people's failure to invent. What if I fail? What are the consequences of failure? I hear so many times. I see it in people that I teach to because their prior lives and part of this life may have been riddled with fears that have led to an over-controlling personality, sometimes referred to as a disordered one. And it has many, many, we'll say, intricacies that are subtle but profound when taken in total, making them impotent to growing in their awareness of God because they seek what they think to be the safety. I would call it the boredom and misery and just tediousness of a life that is not spiritually inventive, and usually not inventive much at all. It saddens me when I see this because it's such a terrible waste. It's so paralyzing for people to function in this illusioned way. And it's so difficult to get them to change. Sometimes I put up, we'll say, choices that lead people into a conflict in themselves. Oftentimes they dislike me for it, so the conflict is projected onto me, but I'm willing to suffer the consequences of that. In order to get these people to take some rash action against their own fears. It's a tough thing to do. I can suggest you can try it yourself by creating meditations in which you contemplate seeing yourself take risky behaviors and interactions to achieve things that you only partially believe you can responsibly do, but you think there's some possibility, and that you have shied away from because the chances of failure seem so ominous and painful and expensive, maybe. What I do is I try to get those around me and myself at times, a few times, this is not too common for me any longer, but experiencing and frozen with this fear, I usually get them angry. Usually the anger is towards me. And I accept the anger because I recognize that this is a means to overcome their fear. Anger is an approach response, fear is an avoidance. So at least if I can get them to be approaching the situation, more is likely to happen than if they're avoiding it. But just approaching isn't good enough if all they're going to do is become destructive to others. In other words, if I can't do this because I'm too afraid, I'll try to prevent you from doing more inventiveness in your life, so then I'll compare myself to you, and I'll feel better because you aren't doing as much as you could because I'm trying to prevent you. That is the worst part of this system, is it leads to sometimes that kind of behavior and that kind of thinking. It's a terrible thing. When you have the experience of the fear, you need to look at the fear as being the destruction of all the joy that you are seeking in life, your ticket and communication with your Creator, and a dullness to existence that is nearly unbearable for most people. This is what you've got to see for yourself in your own contemplations and reflections, so that you can get yourself to change. The self has to become stronger than the subconscious part, the personality as I call it, that wants to just be in control and be safe, not take any chances. Why should I invent? This is the personality speaking. Why should I invent when I can just be non-inventive or inventive in a very mundane sense and not spiritually and reap the rewards of just becoming like everybody else? That's what the personality thinks. What it doesn't realize is that its rate of growth of consciousness is tremendously stymied, that its ability to reach a state of joy is almost gone, and that its life in general becomes tedious and mundane to the point of meaningless. The meaning in life literally disappears as we stop spiritually inventing. Wow. What a cost. Another thing that I do with people, sometimes these are not necessarily anyone connected to me in any student sense, but these may be people that I have some association with, is I usually encourage them to not accept their failures. So let me give you an example. Someone might say, well, I did this job twice, and that's as good as I can get it. And they expect me to say, oh, well, I could see you put a lot of effort in, and effort counts, so as good as you can get it, that's fine. No, I don't do that. Instead, I say, well, I appreciate the effort you've put in. I can see you did a lot of work on it. But you know what? It still doesn't work. How about trying this, this, and this? And how about understanding that it's more important to get it done in a way that you find is as close to godly as you can make it? Let's try that and see how well that works for us, because it's all about us. And also, I want you to redirect your thought to trying to create for others, including me, instead of for some satisfactory issue in yourself. I know that a large number of people believe that you should live your life in ways that leads to your own happiness and satisfaction in what you're doing, and that's it. That's good enough. I don't buy that. Instead, I encourage others around me to live at a new level, increasingly, of improving themselves and helping others to see more of light, to do things that are enlightening, not for themselves necessarily, but for others around them, to create beauty in the world, rather than just meet some proposed obligation. And when I do that, when I do this, again, I get some hostile reactions from folks on occasion, but I find that over time, people start changing. They start developing better character. What do I mean by that? They start seeing in their mind God's view of themselves, and they don't like what they see from a selfish nature that they're exposing, and are willing to make some changes to act less selfishly and to start experiencing more of the joy of God from that of others acting more in God's light as well. This is what I focus the most on throughout my daily life. Pissing people off, generally. Yes, sometimes they accuse me of being perfectionistic. Sometimes they'll say, you just demand too much. You expect too much. Isn't it good enough the way it is? How come you don't let go of this? How come you'll spend 10 times as much money, time, and energy for me, for someone else, not even for yourself, to become more thinking, more inventive, more spiritually creative than just letting it go or letting someone else do it? Why? Well, because, again, the sacrifice here isn't about getting something done. It's about helping someone to experience God more and they're resistant to it. You may consider this as a hallmark for yourself if you can get to that level of functioning. Even if you can only do it a little bit each day, this will clear the cobwebs out. This will get you to the point where you become a spiritual inventor. And this will become the point where you start living your life to be a co-creator with God instead of some follower of some thought forms from others or just someone who's selfish. This is a way of getting over your own selfishness, turning it into a state of perpetual inclusiveness and love. You can reach that point. It's possible. Now, some people tell me, well, I'm just not good at inventing. I can't think of new ways of doing things. I can't see anything that is creative around me. All I ever think of are the old ways that others have done. What am I to do? Well, this is my suggestion. If you have those thoughts, you look at each area that you have the fears that are controlling it, and you look at what you can do to change those fears into statements of purpose, renunciations of fetters and problems in yourself, and ways to be of co-service to others with godly thought and intentions. Then you're taking responsibility for everybody and everything. And that's what you should be doing, by the way. We all need to take responsibility for whatever we can have any positive effect on, or what negative effects we're having on people at the present time, to stop and or change those. Some people may say, well, okay, I've tried that, and then I fail, and instead of inventing something, I just make the situation worse from whatever I'm dealing with. People don't like me anymore for this or that, and things are falling apart around me, and I keep not thinking correctly and keep not getting to the point where I succeed. Well, the greatest success sometimes is in the willingness to fail. And the greatest success comes from co-participating together with others when you alone are failing. Don't try to do everything alone. Ask for help and let people realize that you want to be co-creators with them, not just egotistically say, it's my way or the highway. Instead, say, well, what do you think? What ideas do you have? I need all the ideas I can get. Yes, I have my own, but we can work together. We should work together. More minds means more creation. what creation is good if it's in light and ends in light? And that usually happens when people do so because they're creating together with love and respect for each other, and they want to be in a responsible connection, co-together, co-creatively with God. If God's not part of the equation, you're making a mistake. Regardless of how well you're achieving whatever results you are having, if they're not part of God, you're actually going in the wrong direction. You'll find out at some point in the not-too-distant future, when everything seems to reverse itself and fall apart. Okay, what about creation that is inventive and that you hope is loving, and you try to be responsible, but you're unsure of what is virtuous? There are some ways of creating light that are so convoluted and difficult that people either shun away from them, or their ability to actually achieve the results they are seeking seems tremendously hampered and nearly impossible. What do you do then? Find the most conscious person you can in that area of existence that is willing to be of some help to you and ask for it. It's hard because most of the time, first of all, you have to be humble, and you have to be willing to admit that others are sometimes far superior to yourself in consciousness, and that there has to be mistakes you're making, and the excuses that you've made you have to let go of, and you have to give this person or people who are helping you the opportunity to follow through by you're not resisting or preventing through your own will their ideas and their interactions from helping you. This is a key element to getting over that quagmire and to changing yourself into a great being, is to accept help from others. It can start with your soul and your solar angel. Except for the arhat, the solar angel can be very helpful to a person who is struggling and finding more failure than success. The solar angel will, through in meditation, communicate directly with us and give us some third or fourth or fifth alternative ways of behaving and interacting in situations where we have failed to invent the right thing at the right time and have created tremendous built-up fears and anxieties, and it has left us wounded. We can get around all that, all of it, by literally a few seconds of monadically infused thought can do that. But to reach that level, humility becomes so important, and the willingness to accept the service of others. Most of tonight, I've talked about us serving others, but it's just as important to accept others' service when it's needed because we are failing. We don't have the capability in some way. We have a mix-up in our understanding of our responsibilities or that of others. And it gives us illusioned responses that fail to achieve any kind of invention. And we feel ourselves disappointed and at a loss for how we're going to move forward. And again, look for the exceptional. Find the ones who can be of the greatest help and ask. Instead of trying to convince everybody that you know everything and that you have your handle on everything, admit that you don't. Say, I need help. I need those who really have an understanding to help me gain the same. And if they do have such understanding, they will be themselves humble. They won't ridicule you. They won't harshly ignore or, for the worse, state with hostile thoughts and temperament information and modes of functioning that are totally antithetical to love and God. If you can bring yourself to that level, to those levels, you will produce for yourself a solution for any situation, any, in which you feel stymied and unable to create, and create the kind of solutions that you're looking for. Now, I work in a world that has many seemingly insolvable problems, partly due to the fact that my world and the world of people who serve with me is on the edge. There's so many different issues that need creative solutions at the highest of levels all the time. Almost nothing that we do is easy, because almost everything we're involved with is near impossible. Not because we want to get involved in nearly impossible things, but because there are times when you're challenged by the universe around you, because the challenge is really a call for your help and your saving of the universe, your help to help others. Even though it feels like on a more personal level that you're being attacked, that's not true. Instead of being attacked, you're actually being called in service. And you don't see it that way. You don't understand that that's what's really, really the issue at hand. And it's hard for you. It's hard for us to sometimes see that. We see that it's some impossible situation and we're going to fall apart, instead of it's the opportunity for expanding closer and closer to our awareness and our beingness of God. This is our opportunity. And sometimes those opportunities get lost in self-pity and fear. If that's happening to you, seek the advice of others who are succeeding in that area. Look for the opportunity to co-serve with them and to help them in your service. And enjoy, as much as you can possibly do that, as you start succeeding in these impossible situations, because you look then behind you and you see a path of tremendous creation. Your inventions now have become something that is truly beyond human in many cases. You're functioning beyond who you are, beyond what you are. And it can be done. There is no limit. There's no speed limit on spiritual development. There's no limit on being a great being. The only limit that exists is that which we create in our own fears and within our own perspective of lacking confidence in what we really are. That's why it's good to have this monadic infusion. It's one of the things that it does, if you haven't yet experienced it, is it gives you this sense that you can do anything. And not because it's a false sense, but because it's the true thing. We've just forgotten. Forgotten who we really are and what we really are. Beings of light, moving towards our own creator, but only through co-creation can we get there. And some of that co-creation is in the face of the most serious dilemmas, the most difficult of circumstances, as we advance. So don't think, well, gee, I've done all my advancement, and now I only got worse things to deal with. They're not worse. They're just greater opportunities that mask themselves as tremendous difficulties and problems. And always remember that there is help from sources. For every problem, there is a solution, and for every crisis, there is a miracle. Well, until next week, I want you to keep this in mind. You are the great inventor of your existence, and you will become that which you eventually see yourself becoming. Till next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.